We're talking about our state's regulatory processes here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Guidance documents. These documents tell businesses in our state how to comply with state agency rules, and they essentially explain agency rules to the public. And when lawmakers met last December, they made a law requiring that guidance documents get a public review process. Act 369 restricts the use of guidance documents that help interpret rules for the public. So we're looking closer at this as several agencies opened a comment period for less than a day. Do you use state agencies' guidance documents? What do you use them for? Would you take advantage of a public comment period? We're at 800-642-1234. Bill Leaders is editor of The Progressive. He's president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. Bill, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's good to be here.
Well, before we get started, can you explain what guidance documents are, what they're used for?
Yeah, you did a pretty good job. These are instructions that are developed by state agencies to explain their rules to members of the public. It may be, you know, suggestions for how to apply for funding or programs. It may be guidance to regulated industries about what their requirements are under a particular statute. And for years, these were just promulgated by agencies without any sort of requirement that they invite public opinion about them. But some regulated groups felt that they wanted to have more to say about these guidance documents. In some cases, they were amounting to policy being made in the interpretation, and so they wanted to have input. So among the things that the legislature did in that infamous lame duck session last December, which included measures to strip the governor and the attorney general of some of their powers, was to require that these guidance documents have to go through a process of public comment. They'd be published in the public register, and then the law says that there has to be at least 21 days of public comment that that is set before they are enacted.
And they have to publish these documents on their websites as well.
Right. So the public knows what is being proposed and has, according to the law, at least 21 days of a comment period in which to respond. Now, there is a provision in that law which says that the governor can set a comment period of less than 21 days. He has to do that, give permission to the agency to have a comment period of less than 21 days. And what happened, and which caught my eye in my capacity with the Freedom of Information Council, was that in several cases, state agencies went to the governor and asked for permission to have a comment period of 0 days.
How did that happen?
Well, they were under a timeline that made a 21-day schedule impossible because of the way that the court ruled, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on some of these challenges to the lame duck bills in June, and the deadline for passing and having the comment periods was July 1st. So there just wasn't time. But instead of saying, well, give us a comment period of 3 days or 7 days, three agencies asked for a comment period of 0 days.
So
and
this
that's
is
what was granted.
Department of Public Instruction, Department of Corrections, and Department of Workforce Development?
Yes, those three agencies. And the Department of Health Services had a comment period of 1 day for another set of guidance documents.
So do you think agencies will follow this protocol in the future of asking the governor to have these exceptions?
I kind of doubt it. I think that one of the reasons for calling attention to the fact that it happened now is to raise a concern about it. Absent this pending court deadline, I don't know that they would have the chutzpah to set 0 day comment periods into the future. That just seems to me unlikely as a political, but we'll see. I mean, they could. The law gives them that ability. And in this instance, they did invoke that ability to have a comment period of essentially no time at all.
talking with Bill Leaders. He's editor of The Progressive, and he's been looking into state regulatory practices and these guidance documents. We're talking about how these documents now require a comment period following a revision in the statute during December's extraordinary legislative session. Do you see a need for a public comment period for state agencies' guidance documents? Do you send in your thoughts and opinions when state agencies make new rules? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Bill, the law states that the governor has to approve any comment period shorter than 21 days, as you explained. How has the Evers administration responded to these much shorter windows?
Well, it approved them. So, I mean, it granted the agency request to have the short windows. I should say that the governor's office and the agencies themselves argue that there still is opportunity for the public to comment on these things. The fact that there's a formal comment period does not mean that that's the only time you could have offer a thought about them, or the only time the agencies would pay attention to it. That, you know, even without a formal comment period, anyone can comment on any of these guidance documents and say, I think you got this wrong. I think this could be better. They also say that they haven't received any input from the agencies that had a zero-day comment period, that nobody came subsequent and said, you know, I really want to weigh in on this. So it isn't a matter in which there's routinely large numbers of groups or individuals just dying to weigh in on these documents. But the intention of the law was to formalize a process of input. I should say that that was of great concern to many of these agencies. The requirements of the law created a huge new burden on the agencies and would potentially have gummed up the process of interpreting rules for the public. There was a real potential downside that a lot of people were and still are concerned about, that this law aimed to check the power of the governor really just gums up the mechanism for everyone.
Well, help me understand here. There's this court brief that was filed in May. There are at least 200,000 guidance documents that can be defined as guidance documents across all state agencies. All of them would have to have public hearings and be subjected to other administrative standards. So where are we at with that process, and how does it relate to the public comment period?
It's unclear, at least to me, whether there really is a need for all 200,000 of these guidance documents to go through a review process, or just how cumbersome that would be. It may be a matter of noticing things and allowing a comment period. The public hearing thing would be logistically extremely difficult, but maybe it could be done with, you know, you hold a comment period on 20,000 guidance documents all at once. If you want to comment on any of these things, this is your opportunity to come. I mean, there's ways you could do it that would lessen the burden, I presume. But yeah, I don't know what is actually going to happen in terms of giving notice and having hearings on all of these documents.
Going back to something you said there, some people have argued that having a public comment period is necessary to prevent agencies from using guidance documents to essentially create new rules under the table. Have we seen anything like that?
I think some of the regulated groups feel as though the guidance that was crafted by state agencies amounted to the making of rules. The proposal to create a new comment period was backed by, for instance, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the big business lobby group. And they feel that, you know, this was an opportunity for some agencies to actually make policy and not just interpret it. And they wanted a foot in the door. And they supported this change in the law. They filed briefs before the Supreme Court issued its ruling in June, arguing for that input.
We're talking with Bill Leaders, president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. Coming up, we'll get an update on a lawsuit brought by the McIver Institute accusing Governor Evers of excluding its journalists from press briefings. What are your thoughts on that? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll talk more in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and we're talking with the head of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council, Bill Leaders, is with us. The MacIver Institute filed a lawsuit earlier this month in federal court and alleges Governor Evers' office excluded the news outlet from media events. So what are your thoughts on the MacIver Institute's lawsuit against the Evers administration? Who do you think is in the right here? Join in 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Bill Leaders stays with us. So, Bill, the conservative-leading MacIver Institute sued the Evers administration in federal court. What do we know about the background leading up to this lawsuit?
Well, MacIver News Service says that it was denied entrance to a press briefing that other media were allowed to attend. It also says that when it asked to be put on the media send list for press events and other information from the governor's office, that did not happen. That the governor's office selectively excluded it from receiving these notices and barred its reporters from attending one of these briefings. So it filed a lawsuit in federal court challenging those denials as a violation of the organization's free press rights, and that case is pending. Now, my group promptly weighed in on this, and I gave a statement in support of the MacIver Institute and expressed that I felt that MacIver should be afforded all of the courtesies as any other news organization. I also expressed that I thought that if Tony Evers has what it takes to be governor, he ought to be able to withstand the inclusion of conservative media at press events. It's petty, I think, and it's probably illegal for the governor's office to selectively exclude certain media, presumably because they don't like the media and its message.
Can you help us understand who the MacIver Institute is, a little bit about their history and what they publish?
Well, it's a conservative think tank based in Wisconsin. I know it receives money from the Bradley Foundation and other conservative groups. It does run this news service, which does reporting on state news primarily. It does have a conservative point of view. It's a free market oriented philosophy, and they do have a pretty good record, I think, when it comes to support for open government. Many conservative groups do have a good record in supporting our open meetings and our open records law, and that's certainly true of MacIver.
How has the Evers administration responded to this?
Well, they did not deny that they excluded a reporter from this press event. And so far as I know, they have not denied that they would not include the group on its send list. They may have rectified that or intend to rectify that. They should rectify that and include the group. I think they... indications now are that they will fight the lawsuit. Maybe they'll offer some sort of settlement, which will mean that the state will end up paying MacIver something in terms of its legal cost in order to settle the lawsuit. I don't know that. I don't know that there's a settlement in the works, but that is always a possibility that government will settle rather than go through a protective lawsuit process in which in the end it might lose. Now, why would I say it might lose? Well, it's the most comparable case that I can think of to this was what happened with Jim Acosta at CNN last year when the Trump administration revoked Jim Acosta's press credentials, and CNN sued, and a judge issued an injunction overturning the revocation of Jim Acosta's press credentials. And then the government caved and said, okay, he can have his press credentials. We're not going to fight anymore. And it settled the case with CNN. So that's a prior example that is comparable. It doesn't appear to be legal for government to selectively exclude media because it doesn't like a particular reporter or it doesn't like a particular news outlet. Now, government can be selective about who it extends special access to. Like, no one would dispute the ability of President Trump to give an interview
exclusive
to Sean Hannity,
right.
But not to Rachel Maddow. I mean, he has that freedom to give additional access, but I don't think that governments are on constitutionally sound ground sound footing when they selectively exclude media from access that other media have.
We're looking at press freedom now with Bill Leaders. He's editor of The Progressive, president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. What are the governor's responsibilities when it comes to maintaining freedom of the press and equal access to his administration, in your opinion? Is it okay for lawmakers to block certain accounts on social media? Join in with your thoughts here, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Bill, let's look at another lawsuit, the One Wisconsin Now's lawsuit against Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Representative John Nygren, both who are Republicans. One Wisconsin Now is a liberal cause. And they're looking at this through Twitter and the blocking on Twitter. Can you tell us more about this suit, which is filed in 2017 and then decided this January?
Yeah, the One Wisconsin Now, a liberal advocacy group, did sue three members of the Wisconsin State Legislature, including Robin Voss and John Nygren, for blocking their access to the legislators' social media accounts. This also has a federal parallel where a number of groups and individuals sued President Trump for selectively blocking access to his Twitter account. And in that case, the courts ruled against Trump and in favor of the requesters in Wisconsin. The courts ruled against the legislators and in favor of One Wisconsin Now. The most recent development in that case, which was decided in January, is that the state has agreed to pay the legal fees for One Wisconsin Now, and it's $200,000, which is a huge chunk of change. We need to remember that this is money that's coming out of the taxpayers' pocket for the bad decision to try to defend in court a policy of exclusion of certain individuals because lawmakers didn't like those individuals. There was another case that I was personally involved in where I sued Representative Scott Krug for denying access to electronic copies of records that I requested in electronic form. That case I also won in the court level. I won my case was affirmed at the appellate court level, and the state has agreed to pay legal costs. I think that just happened this week. That was about $100,000. So just in these two cases, taxpayers have had to shell out about a third of $1 million, $300,000, in order to pay for the failed efforts of members of the legislature to pursue a policy of secrecy.
Why are these issues going to court in the first place? Why can't they be settled through conversations, through negotiations?
See, that's always my first preference, and I would urge anyone who has a beef with a public official to do everything they can, short of litigation, in order to get the records they need or the access that they need. But sometimes they just say no. And the only way you can force the issue is to bring a lawsuit. Now, this is a risky proposition to sue because there's no guarantee that you're going to win. But if you do win, the law says that you are entitled to recovery of your legal cost, and these can be substantial, and in both of these cases, they were.
Do you anticipate seeing more lawsuits like this as constituents have more ways to get access to their lawmakers, especially on social media, Twitter?
I think we're going to see more lawsuits like this because there's a culture of contempt for the public's right to know, which I think is taking heart among certain members of the state legislature. I think this is something new that we've seen in the last 5 years or so. I wouldn't have said this was true before, but I do think it's true now that there are certain members of the legislature who are fundamentally opposed to the notion that they should be held accountable to the people through open records and the open meetings law, and they're determined to embrace as much secrecy as they can get away with, and that is going to result in more lawsuits. One of the tricks that they're doing now is to charge huge sums of money to locate the records, because the law does allow to records custodians to charge a fee for their cost of locating records. Now they say, oh, it took us 20 hours and it's going to cost you $1,000. If you want these records, you have to pay us that $1,000 for the location energy that we put into it.
Used to be the cost of making copies.
Yeah, and you know, one of the clues that these charges are bogus is sometimes reporters will make multiple requests or request to multiple officials for a certain category of records and say 3 out of 4 of the officials they asked for records will say, here's your records, no charge. And then there'll be a legislator who'll say, if you want these records, you owe me $700.
So it's not even across the board is what you're
saying. Well, I think that there's evidence that some lawmakers are using their ability to charge location fees abusively in order to frustrate requesters and keep them from getting the records that they deserve.
Bill, thank you for joining us.
Sure.
Bill Leaders is editor of The Progressive and president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. Coming up, we look at large-scale industrial farming and how it impacts rural life here in Wisconsin. Farmers, we want to hear from you. How do you manage runoff? What strategies have you put into practice for your farm operation? And what's your take on putting a moratorium on CAFOs, these large livestock operations? We're at 800-642-1234. We'll look at issues hitting family farms right after this news update on the Ideas Network.